You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it just gets sunnier from now on. We'll learn about the science of the winter solstice.
First, almost a quarter of Wisconsin schools are reporting that they're having a hard time hiring teachers. A report from the Public Policy Forum earlier this year showed that the state lost 2.4% of its teachers from 2010 to 2014, while the number of students in public schools held steady.
According to a new Milwaukee Journal Sentinel report, some educators are blaming Act 10. It's now been about 5 years since Governor Walker passed the law, which had a major impact on collective bargaining, especially in the education sector.
Dave Umhafer joins us now to tell us more. He's an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His article on Act 10 and Wisconsin's teacher shortage is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Dave, first off, how widespread is the teacher shortage?
Well, there's debate about that, but if you ask a school superintendent, especially in rural areas, they will definitely tell you that they're getting far fewer applicants than they used to. They're having trouble finding substitute teachers. It takes longer to fill openings. It's a pretty significant situation. It isn't affecting every district, so hasn't reached like a full-blown crisis yet, but it's definitely noticeable for many, many districts.
And when we look at how many young people are training, going to school to become teachers here in Wisconsin, what do we see?
Yeah, there's been a drop-off in people entering education schools with the intention of becoming teachers. And it's really about 6 years running now. Some of that's to be expected. The economy's improving. Private sector jobs, in some respects, pay more at the entry level. And the teacher market has always been sort of sensitive to the economy in cycles. But, you know, it's down 30% in a period of about 5 years. And it's entering a long period of drought here, and there's uncertainty about whether it's going to change anytime soon.
Now, it sounds like some educators think that you want to find the cause for the teacher shortage. You look at Act 10, that's when everything went south. Is there data to back that up?
I mean, it's a tempting target because it was such a prominent situation with collective bargaining going away, the protests in Madison, all the negativity about teaching and so forth. And so what you're seeing is veteran educators especially really wanting to place the blame on Act 10, but it's really just one of the factors. The downturn in the number of students entering the teaching market started before Act 10, and that really needs to be pointed out. Plus, Veronica, there's a lot of other changes that are playing a role here. Teachers have less authority. They have less freedom. It's harder to enter the profession. There's more testing to get in. There's tougher evaluations. There's more standardized tests. So there's been a loss of kind of independence. So what you've got overall is it's harder to get in. It's harder work, longer hours. The pay is somewhat less predictable than it was during the collective bargaining heyday. And some of the special kind of job protections have gone away. So if you throw all that in the pot, Act 10 and all these other factors, it's a lot to overcome.
And Dave, you've got a list in your piece about some of the reasons that teachers that there are grounds for dismissal for teachers around the state. Can you tell us a few of them?
Sure. The you know, what happened was that very few teachers were outright fired under the old collective bargaining agreements. It was a little bit looser in terms of conduct and misconduct. And now things like, you know, smoking on school grounds, boisterous behavior, things like that can get you disciplined or fired. And some of them are kind of vague, and they make teachers concerned when they read things in their employee handbook, like you must remain positive about your school district, even in your off hours. So, you know, what exactly does that mean, and how does that play out when you're thinking about posting something on Facebook or things like that? So job security is definitely down, and the rule books are a lot thicker in terms of what teachers, even dress codes, teachers having to conform much more rigidly to professional dress codes.
We're talking with Dave Umhafer right now. He's an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's with us now to talk about a teacher shortage in many Wisconsin school districts. And Dave, you talked to some people who were students looking to become teachers. What did they tell you about the experience for them?
You know, the students we talked to are so passionate. You know, they heard about Act 10. Obviously, they were in high school probably, but they went ahead and went to school for it anyways, and they hung in there. And there's kind of a generational divide. I mean, the kids who are getting into it, they weren't part of the union collective bargaining era, and they don't really know, in a sense, what they might be missing. So they tend to be more positive about it. But there's still definitely a drop-off in the number of students getting into it. One of the union leaders we talked to in Green Bay said that, you know, she still feels positive about the future of the profession because these students that are coming out are so well-versed, and they're getting better training, and they're still super passionate. So that was kind of an upbeat way that we ended the story.
And one aspect you look at, a possible silver lining, is that there could be greater flexibility for teachers to have a better salary hope of more raises in the future, and the way that might happen now as opposed to before Act 10. What do you see there?
Absolutely. It's kind of haves and have-nots. If your district can afford to pay you a bonus to stay or pay you a hiring bonus to take you away from another school district, you might get $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 more than you would have in the old days. But on the flip side, teachers can no longer count on getting regular raises. You might see a number of teachers getting zero or very small inflationary raises, where in the past they could look at a salary grid and say, all right, I started at $30,000, but you know, in 20 years, I'm going to be making $70,000. And those days are pretty much gone, so it's far less certain as to financial planning, looking ahead and saying, how am I going to be doing?
Now, one thing in Wisconsin that you examine is the attitude toward teachers and what sort of esteem teachers are held in this state as an Act 10 state now. So what do we know about how teachers are thought of in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, the Act 10, the protests were such a hot, red-hot moment, and many teachers, of course, left their districts for days at a time to join in the protests, and the protests went on for so long that there was definitely a backlash against teachers, including among family members of teachers, and it was heartbreaking for us to talk to so many teachers who have lost touch with friends and family members because they heard from their loved ones that, hey, you guys are overpaid, or you should take a hit on your pension and so forth. And that, you know, that kind of fight didn't really play out in a lot of other states. So, and even 5 years later, it still burns people. So it's just a cloud that kind of hangs over the profession here.
And did you see that cloud, you know, having a bit of a shadow over some of these young students you talked to who were going into teaching in Wisconsin?
Well, I'll tell you, the sad stories we heard about students in high school who wanted to become teachers and were talked out of it by, you know, their favorite teacher. And if you think about the word of mouth effect, Veronica, you know, tens of thousands of teachers, very, very negative with their own students and family and friends about joining this profession, the ripple effect of that across the state is, it's like this giant, you know, negative marketing campaign against teaching. And there are many teachers we talk to who are upset at their fellow teachers for being so negative, because it's really starting to affect the supply of people entering the profession.
We leave it there. Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime. It was great.
That was Dave Umhafer. He's an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he was with us there talking about a teacher shortage in many Wisconsin school districts and why that might be. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about the science of the winter solstice.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Don Sanford feels a deep connection to water, from sailing to ice boating. He tells us about the long history of ice boating on Madison's Lake Mendota and the pull he feels to the water's edge.
Ice boaters call Madison the ice boating capital of the universe. And that's only because we have a friendly rivalry with our friends down on in Williams Bay, and they call themselves the ice boating capital of North America. So members of the Four Lakes Ice Yacht Club, not to be outdone, we always take it up a notch. To have beautiful ice boating conditions relies on Mother Nature, and we have to have a big sheet of ice, maybe at the minimum 6-8 inches thick, and ideally without any snow, like this tabletop. I grew up on Cazenovia Lake. It's about 25-30 miles southeast of Syracuse. And I had the great joy to my parents had a cottage on that lake, and that's where I was in the summertime from probably the time I was about 2 months old until I moved out here to Wisconsin. And so I always think about that lake. And what I've discovered, anybody who's grown up on any body of water, doesn't matter whether it's a river or lake, that's imprinted in you. That recollection of growing up on that water and the things you did when you were a kid on that water, you're stuck with it. You can't get away from it. And anytime you start talking about, you know, your youth, misspent or not, you begin thinking about things that happened to you while you were afloat. I rarely think about baseball games I played, but I always think about things we did on the water. People began building something, had to do something in the wintertime, and people began modifying sailboats to go across the ice. And it was in the late 1890s when really the father of Madison ice boating, Charles Bernard, went to the Columbian Exposition in Chicago, and he saw a stern steering Class A ice boat that had been brought to the exposition from someplace on the Hudson River where they raced big ice boats. And he had an idea that he could improve that design, make it a little better, make it maybe a little safer, but certainly make it better. And he brought that idea back, and in his boat shop on East Gorham Street, he built what later became known as the Madison style. And these things were, for their time, this was cutting-edge technology. I've sailed on them. They're a little scary, maybe a lot scary. And Bernard had a fleet of these things. In the wintertime, you could go down there and pay a quarter and go ice boating. Just rent one of these things and go tear around on the ice. I think you had to bring your own buffalo skin robes. I've always been interested in history, and I've found Madison history to be particularly interesting. And knowing why certain things happened, it was really about the climate that drove this area into becoming a real popular ice boating spot. I don't know how many other lakes there are in this state, thousands. On any lake in any part of the state, there are stories like this.
Don Sanford is the author of On Fourth Lake, A Social History of Lake Mendota. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, well, you wouldn't know it with all the snow on the ground, but technically today is the first day of winter, which also makes it the shortest day of the year. The good news is that each day after today will grow slightly longer, which means the nights will get progressively shorter.
Jim Lattice joins us now. He's the director of the UW-Madison Space Place, and he'll be teaching us a little bit about the science of the solstice. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, shortest day of the year, what's happening between the Earth and the sun that makes this the shortest day of the year?
Well, so it's really the period of daylight that's shortest, right? So every day is 24 hours.
Sure.
but it's the division between the daylight and the nighttime, the darkness, is what varies. And so it's today that's the minimum period of daylight, the minimum time between sunrise and sunset. So what's going on is that in our hemisphere is tipped away from the sun as much as it can be tipped away today, which has the result that the sun, when we look at it, is as low in the sky today as it can be. So it actually was a moment when the sun was farthest south, which was early this morning at, like, I don't know, 4:44 in the morning or something like that. But the whole day then is the day on which that happens is the day of shortest daylight. So that's what we talk about.
Now, we think about this in a way as a celebratory thing because we're heading back toward the light.
Yeah,
the
sun's
turning
around. But
it never really feels like it. It's so incremental, it almost seems like you can't notice until something like March, if you ask me. I mean, how gradual is this?
Well, pretty gradual, just minutes a day. In fact, right around the solstice is when the change is smallest, because the term solstice really sort of means where the sun stands still. So it's in it's moving southward during the year up to this point, and then it pauses, so to speak. It doesn't really pause, but it's turning around to go back north, and so we're at the turnaround point, which is what it's called in some languages. And so we don't see very much change right around the solstice in terms of the period of daylight. And you see the maximum sort of change around the equinoxes. So when you say you don't notice it till March, that's
about right.
That's about right, yeah.
My assumption would be it's the shortest day. That means this would be the earliest sunset of the year. And my understanding I've learned today, I'm probably wrong about that.
Yeah, and that's one reason why the solstice doesn't quite match up, because the day of actual earliest sunset, which is probably what we notice more when we're coming home from work and it's darkest or something, if we do that on a regular basis, that was back on December 7th. And we won't actually have the latest sunrise until January 3rd. So that if we kept time by sundials, which is the way we ought to do it, then and in fact, today would be the day of the latest sunrise and the earliest sunset. But we don't tell time by the sun anymore. We use clocks, which go at a uniform rate all year, unlike the sun. So because the sun gets ahead and behind of clock time during the course of the year, the sun is actually a little bit ahead of what we call the mean sun, which is the clock sun, back there in early December, and sets earlier. And then it takes a little while for that to even out, and it lags behind the clock sun, what we call the mean sun, by early January, and so we don't get our latest sunrise until then.
And you mentioned that this is the shortest day because we're tilted the farthest away from the sun. Is that something that's always a constant? We hear about these minute changes sometimes to the way the Earth moves. Are there any changes there? Is that always a constant? Basically, I'm wondering if there's ever any hope for it not being so dark in Wisconsin. Not
no,
in my lifetime, probably.
The inclination of the Earth, of the Earth's rotation. So we're really talking about the Earth's rotational axis and the angle that it makes with the Earth's orbital plane. And so that angle is pretty close to fixed. At least you can't expect any relief in the near term. That angle stays pretty steady from year to year, or even, you know, century to century. So the only variations would be really, really minor, almost undetectable sort of variations in that. So it is when our hemisphere is tipped away. You could, of course, winter in the south or something along that line, in which then your hemisphere is tipped towards the sun. So our winter solstice is the southern summer solstice, of course.
What if everybody in one hemisphere jumped at the same time? Have we ever tried
that? No, we've never tried that. We should try it.
We're talking to Jim Lattice from the UW-Madison Space Place about the science of the solstice. So I'm curious, maybe this is a dumb question, I don't know. So here's the plane. I'm holding one arm out. This is the Earth's orbit around the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And our rotation I'm holding my arm at an angle now, doesn't quite match up with it. It's close, but not quite. Do we know why it's not lined up?
Well, it's not even too close. We're actually 23 and a half degrees tilted from what would be perfectly perpendicular if the axis were perpendicular. And there are plenty of planets whose rotational axis is closer to perpendicular, and the presumption is that that's how they formed. Mm-hmm. So there are plenty of planets, though, that are even more extreme than Earth. Well, a few planets that are more extreme than Earth. And we don't know why exactly, although one reason that's often suggested is that when the moon formed, our best science at the moment tells us that that was a collision with a rather large other planet that no longer exists, and the Earth-Moon system is kind of the remains of that collision. And so the characteristics of a major collision like that could easily have shifted the rotational axis of the Earth before the collision by a considerable angle, by certainly that much. So that's the current thinking on why our rotational axis is not closer to perpendicular to our orbital plane.
And should we know some cultures, so they're not around anymore, but some cultures have observed this as a kind of, you know, holy day or holiday.
Certainly.
What about you? Is this something that you think of as a special day as someone who studies space?
Well, it's certainly a nice natural sort of marker rather than something arbitrary that we find on the calendar. My father-in-law, every solstice, sends me solstice greetings, and I respond. So it is a nice turnaround point, and it used to be a fairly special point. You know, another name for it is midwinter day, and you mentioned earlier that it's the beginning of winter. So why is it also midwinter day? And earlier cultures, and particularly the Celtic European cultures, thought of their seasons differently and thought of this as the depth of winter, which in a sense it really is, since it's the depth of the sun's path through the sky. So I think it is special in that way.
Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
We're talking there with Jim Lattis, director of the UW-Madison Space Place. We've been learning about the winter solstice.
Coming up, holiday food traditions are about more than the food. They're about memory. We'll find out why. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Storytelling with a Beat on Snap Judgment. This week's theme is metal. That's as in M-E-T-T-L-E. You think you know what you're made of until someone comes along and tests you. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, with the holiday season in high gear, from Christmas and Hanukkah to New Year's Eve, we're doing a lot of eating and drinking. And it's not just eating to live. It's the tradition of cutout cookies or New Year's champagne or latkes with applesauce.
Our next guest says the act of eating is closely connected with memory, personal identity, and our sense of place. Now we look at why food memories are so powerful and which foods are more about your spirit than your stomach.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What foods trigger an emotional memory for you? Is it the taste or even just the smell that brings back thoughts of people or times past, family? Or is there maybe a food that has a sad association for you? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Kyle Cherik joins us now. He's a culinary historian and the host of the TV show Wisconsin Foodie, which airs on Wisconsin Public Television. Kyle, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Hello to both of you and happy holidays.
Well, you did a TEDx talk on this recently, Kyle. What is the connection between the food we eat and our brains and the way we remember things?
Well, it goes way back to our very evolution, and even before we as humanoids evolved. There's some argument, but not much really, that within the fossil record, as we came out of the oceans and started crawling and then eventually walking, There's great evidence that that's when our spines developed to a much different density and so on and so forth. And they almost operated as a very primitive second brain. And it was that differentiation of taste within them, basically, you know, bitters being poison and what might nourish us being good, that we really, that was the avenue for animal kind to start evolving. And you've got to go forward many millions of years. But anthropologists now pretty much agree that our ability to cook about 2 million, 1.8 million years ago is what separated us from the animals. And, of course, even vegetarians out there know that when you cook meat, there's that Maillard effect, and there's about 200 more flavors available in cooked meat than there is in raw meat, and it's much easier to digest. You get a great deal more nutrients. You get that much more energy. And then on and on, when we discovered breads and started crushing ancient grains and so forth, our stomachs literally got smaller and our brains got much larger because we could go further on less. And we just expanded forward and started imprinting. There's actually a part in our brains called the flavor cortex that we can trace way back into the fossil record and where it would have been in those skulls.
So it served us well to have such a close association with the way things taste, and it's made our brains bigger. And now we're left with this really powerful sense of taste and the emotional link that goes with it. So why do you think now there's this emotional thing that we have so much?
Well, the truth is when we eat, it's not just for calories or as nutrition or fuel, but as a constant overlay and a reminiscence of our memories. Bitter is typically poisonous and breast milk is sweet. So we're programmed from the earliest, I mean, really the first act of eating, if you want to say it, and human touch and warmth and everything like that, in ideal circumstances, is that experience with the mother. And so we're programmed for sweet and starchy and fatty things, foods, from the get-go. And as I say in my TEDx talk, jokingly, you know, Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am. I'll raise him a hamburger," and and I think that's what has moved us along. As we eat these things, we imprint, and they start to mean home and comfort, and there's an association within our physiology for a lowering of stress and a higher sense of viability within our environments. And this is in a very scientific way, but those things start to connect to other pathways within our brains and our nervous systems and our gut, which is beginning to be called, it's a second brain, the nervous system, the vagus, that connects with all those microbes you've heard about from the probiotic commercials, where we associate this is good for us. This means that we get to go forward as a species, and this is home.
Kyle, on a personal level, you've been thinking about this a lot, obviously. What are some of your most powerful food memories, the foods that put you in another time and place?
Sure. Well, I have a birthday actually coming up tomorrow, and this past weekend we celebrated a dinner at a Eastern European restaurant that I love here in the state, and there's a recipe for Hungarian stuffed peppers that they serve that are identical. I'm Hungarian. Identical to the stuffed peppers that my mom and my grandmother would make. I can't actually seem to make them at home. I can't recreate them. But I can go to this restaurant, and it almost brings me to tears every time because it's that imprint, and it's that sense of personal history, and it's that connection to love, really.
We're talking with Kyle Cherik right now, host of Wisconsin Foodie on Wisconsin Public Television, talking about this primal link between food and memory and our ideas about who we are. And Kyle, speaking about that identity part of it, how does that come into play when we're eating food? How does it get tangled up with what we think, where we come from, who we think of ourselves as?
Sure. Well, you know, we live in a processed food age, and we have for, I would say, really about 50 years. My joke with my kids is always, you know what farmers in the 1930s called organic vegetables? Vegetables. So the question is, and there's so many memories that are tied to the holidays, but when you buy that, I don't know anybody that likes fruitcake, but let's say you do, and you buy it at a store versus making your own, you're imprinting with those processed flavors. when you buy the sugar cookies that they have at the grocery store, and I'm not trying to pillarize anyone, but versus taking the time and the energy to make your own sugar cookies and decorate, you imprint, and you do for your loved ones and your friends and your office mates that you bring them to and so forth. And the more that we subcontract our flavor imprints out to the world, the more that we lose a little bit more of ourself and our identity and our sense of place.
So this sounds like a case here that we'll be happier, more connected if we cook more.
Yeah, listen, occupy your kitchen. I'm not a revolutionary, but I'm a radical in that capacity. Occupy your kitchen, even if you don't know how to cook. The best way to learn how to cook is to start doing it.
And you do this, right? You have a once a month really fancy meal, lay out the good linens, the crystal,
and
you experiment with food.
Yeah, we do something called Family Formal Night, and we bring out the china and our great flatware and so forth, and the kids really love it. And it's not always that we cook something incredibly fancy, though we'll experiment that way, but it's one, a terrific way for them to learn manners and be comfortable in those environments. But we force ourselves to reach. And if we hadn't done that, there are some terrific recipes and flavors we never would have exposed ourselves to at home. But it cost maybe $10 more or took 2 more hours to prepare. But the benefits were worldly.
You know, it's funny thinking back. One of the fond memories I have as a kid is my mom making meatloaf, which I think she'd be mortified at. She thought that was kind of a giving up kind of food. I loved it. I like the leftover meatloaf sandwiches the next day. It isn't about the fanciness of the food, is it? It's about the connections.
Not at all. Yeah, it's not about the fanciness of the food in the least. One of the favorite things that children and all of us have for breakfast is what we call bear mush, but it's really just farina. It's cream of wheat, and we add a little bit of cinnamon and a little bit of vanilla. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's three ingredients, four if you include water. but it's an imprint, and for the rest of their lives, if they have someone else's cream of wheat, it won't taste quite right. It won't taste quite like home, just as someone else's meatloaf, Rob, just isn't the same as your mom's.
Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Happy holidays, everyone. Thank you for including me in this discussion, and Happy New Year.
Happy holidays to you, too. That was Kyle Cherik with us, the host of Wisconsin Foodie on Wisconsin Public Television. And he's with us there as we have a conversation right now about the link between food and memory.
And now it is your turn at 800-642-1234. We want to hear from you. What foods do you associate with your strongest memories? What smell or flavor takes you back to a person, a place, a time in your life? Is there a food that has disappeared from your life? You can't quite find it just the way it used to be, like that stuffed Hungarian pepper that Kyle was talking about. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking right now about the connection between food and memory and identity. We're here in the holiday season when we're eating and drinking a lot of these foods that trigger memories of family and home and people.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a food that's connected to a memory, a time, a place, maybe a person in your life? Is there a food that you miss? Nobody makes it the right way anymore compared to the way you had it, maybe when you were a kid. Call in now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Mary joining us in La Crosse. Mary, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
Well, every year at Christmas, my grandma makes oyster stew, and it is terrible. she makes it every year, and I remember every year being forced to try it. Uh-huh. And you get the tiniest bowl of broth, avoid all the oysters, and load it up with crackers. So, you know, not every memory is a good one, but it's worth trying once, right?
So you try it and you remember it. I mean, is this something that you think you'll ever want to make down the road when you're the person hosting?
Probably not. It's not very popular with everyone in the family. Uh-huh. I think it's more a tradition for her than it is
Some traditions don't need to continue forever, maybe. Mary, thanks a lot for sharing that story.
We'll go next to Linda with us in Madison. Linda, hi.
Hi. I've always had fabulous oyster stew that my mom made, so it could just be that some people...
That wasn't your niece, was it?
But the two that I called in about, and both I remember as a young child, the first was when it was springtime. My mom and me chives in Richland County grown by the back door. My mom would get out some rye bread, put cottage cheese on top of that, and then sprinkle the chives on top of that.
Oh, that sounds kind of good. Very fresh.
And the other one was pickled apple slices. Even as a grown-up, I see apple slices that are pickled, and I get excited.
Wow. Oh, those are great memories, Linda. Thank you so much for sharing those. And, yeah, the growing out back, you know, we had a mulberry tree and some raspberries out in our backyard, and definitely you don't get to eat mulberries very often. They don't keep very well, so you have to find the tree. People made fun of me for standing there eating mulberries off the tree.
Probably because
your face was all purple,
right?
Granted, yeah. But those that fresh-grown stuff right out the door is definitely a special memory.
Oh, absolutely. Well, thanks a lot for that call. And we'll go next to Ryan in Green Bay. Ryan, hi.
Hi, how are you? Happy holidays.
Yeah, you too. What did you want to share?
When I was listening to your speaker, the guy that was on before he started taking calls, it reminded me so much of Frank Herbert's Dune. Are you familiar?
Oh yeah.
I know about the series. I've seen one of the bad movies, but I haven't read the
book. I've read and reread it. Ryan.
Okay, yeah, me as well. So there's six books, and the spice is it brings back ancestral memories. It lets you tune into like genetic memories is kind of the concept in there, and it's something that they eat in this book, and it's called spice, which I think might be metaphoric because we're talking about scents and flavors and such. So I just thought it was really, really interesting how, like, this whole concept is kind of inside that book somehow in there, you know.
Ryan, thanks a lot. And, yeah, I remember one character is doing this. This is the far future, and they're remembering their family, their genealogy back to ancient Greece, Agamemnon. So it is, like, kind of a symbol of what we're talking about. Obviously, we can't eat foods and remember back to our ancestors in that way, but
yeah, very
a good
cool.
symbol of that, yeah.
Oh, nice. Well, Ryan, thanks for telling that bit of literary history and memory there. And we'll go next to Cherry joining us in Wausau. Hi there.
Hi. I remember there were five of us kids, and we were all, I remember going back to maybe when I was five or six, we couldn't sit on the couch. We all had to sit on the floor in front of the TV. There wasn't enough room for the adults. But I remember suppers because there were five of us and sometimes not enough meat for a meat meal every night. I remember pork and beans and mashed potatoes.
So a simple.
Very simple.
Right.
Protein and starch. But when I see pork and beans or smell them or we serve them once in a great while, it takes me right back to sitting on the floor when I was a little kid with my brothers and sisters around me.
So. Oh, yeah, that's a great memory. Yeah, those smells, too, smelling them or seeing them. And sometimes even if you have them again, you feel like you're back there.
Thanks so much for that call, Cherry. We are taking your calls about food and memories. Is there a food that brings you back to a time or place in your life? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Nick is with us now in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Nick? What's your food memory?
Well, growing up, you know, Christmas time, this is actually a great story for right now. My mom always made Christmas cookies, and we looked at my mom like she was Betty Crocker. everything was made from scratch. I don't think she believed in measuring spoons or cups or any of that stuff. And her cookies were second to none. Well, actually, it was just a couple weeks ago I asked her, hey, would you mind sending me the recipe for the cookies? Now that I have kids of my own, I'd like to make some Christmas cookies with them. And she literally took a picture of the Betty Crocker cookbook cookies. And she had a little note in there that said, quarter teaspoon of cinnamon. That's the difference. So I actually made a batch of the original, according to Betty Crocker, and according to my mother. And the Betty Crocker ones tasted horrible to me, and the my mom's with just a little bit of cinnamon were wonderful.
Wow, and I bet it was kind of cool seeing her handwriting there saying quarter teaspoon cinnamon.
I was actually expecting to see a recipe card that was, you know, 40 years old and had, you know, tons of stains and little drops of vanilla all over it, and here's the Betty Crocker cookbook. I'm like, I could have gotten that, but you know what? It's still for my mother. It's still, you know, it has been around that long for us. So a great memory for us.
What a great story, Nick.
Definitely.
Thank you so much for sharing that one. That's a great one,
Mom,
for this time of year.
Mom wasn't Betty Crocker. She was better than Betty Crocker.
She did her one better. Let's go next to Bill. Bill's with us in Sheboygan Falls. Bill, hi.
Hello. Hello. Nice program.
Thank you.
Coming from a North German neighborhood in central Illinois, well, kale is now the modern vogue in chips and salads. The real way to make kale, and you can find it on the internet, is to strip it after frost, so it must be eaten in the wintertime, and boil it for 2 hours or three, add a piece of pork, sausage or ham, and a little oatmeal to thicken it. When my family made it, they made it in gallons and would share it among the sisters. I had in town three sisters, three aunts, and the person making kale was subject to a visit with a take-home order.
Do you still make that, Bill?
I make it for once a year for family events, but I don't have enough appreciation where I live right now. But for family events, they recall that and are glad to see it come in the door.
Ah, wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing another beautiful story about food, which, you know, gets at how sometimes it tastes better because of the memories. I swear,
Definitely.
There's something, the secret ingredient is the magic of the memory.
There are foods that I liked in the past that I wonder if it would be the same now, because it's not that time and place in my life.
Right, absolutely. Well, Bill, appreciate that call.
We'll go next as we share food memories and the connection between food and memory. Jan is with us next in Verona. Jan, hi.
Hi. My memory is my mother always making chop suey, which is absolutely nothing like the Chinese chop suey, but the thing she made with it was gingerbread, fresh gingerbread, which smelled so good, loaded with butter, and it was just really yummy. But the other thing she used to make was a graham cracker cake, where we got to crush the graham crackers that got put into the cake. And she always made it for my birthday. It had a cream cheese frosting, and it was delicious.
Wow.
And just a couple of years ago, my sister actually made me a graham cracker cake for my birthday, which was amazing to get another taste of that again. But the fellow who was talking about meatloaf, my mom always used to make a meatloaf that was so good. It had egg and milk and bread and carrots in it.
Carrots.
And yeah, and it just kind of fell apart. But one of the best things was to have the sandwiches the next day on plain old bread with ketchup.
Yep, or barbecue sauce, I would do.
Or barbecue sauce, maybe a little mayonnaise stuck in there.
A lot of meatloaf lovers here.
Yeah, Jan, thank you so much. Some great memories there. And that special cake that you always get for your birthday has got to be on a lot of people's lists, I bet.
Jan, thanks a lot. And let's go next to Mike in Green Lake County. Mike, hi.
Hi, happy holidays.
You too.
Great, great show. Great family memories of going to Grandma's house and cracking hickory nuts in the basement with a hammer on a brick or an anvil and working for a long time picking out those little nut meats on the shelves and then Grandma making the best hickory nut cake.
Wow, that sounds delicious. And, you know, you were really involved doing it with your hands, and then you had them put it in a cake. Is that something you still eat today? Do you have the recipe?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that sounds delicious and a wonderful memory, too. Sometimes you put a little elbow grease into it. You have to work to get those nuts, and it tastes better.
That's true. Thank you so much for all your calls. You can keep sharing your food memories on the Central Time Facebook page. Something I always wonder about is, of all the stuff I cook, what are my kids going to look back, if anything, and remember fondly and maybe ask to make when they're grown-ups?
Yeah, we've got some requests already. My kids love this chocolate chip cookie cake, which is nothing special at all. It's chocolate chip cookies. It's an icebox cake, really, from the 50s with mocha whipped cream, and they want it every year.
Thanks again for all of your calls. Again, share your food memories on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.